This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
It's been a great privilege for me to be with all of you, and I'm grateful to Terry, and privileged to be with this marvelous music. And I have, like you, been so moved by Ann's testimony. And I have been so glad to be engaged with Andy as we've shuttled it back and forth. In order to get where I want to go, I will summarize the movement of the Old Testament in three easy steps. First, from the beginning, God's people have understood themselves as chosen. So the promise made to Abraham and to Sarah about land, name, great nation, blessing, is unconditional. It is without commandment. Second, Moses added the big if. So in Exodus 19, before the Decalogue in 20, God says, if you will infinitively, absolutely hear my voice and keep my commandment, you'll be my people. The implication is, if you don't, you won't. And Deuteronomy, which is the belated voice of Moses, added to that if chapter after chapter. As you know, Deuteronomy is the great architect of election. For you are God's holy people, not because you're big or because you're righteous, but because I said so. Punkt. That's that marvelous Deuteronomy 7:6. We don't quote Deuteronomy 7:5. Deuteronomy 7:5 says you shall break their images, smash their symbols, hew down their idols. It's all the violent verbs you can think of. So I have been wondering, I won't impose this on you, but I have been wondering, is it possible to be God's chosen people without it ending in violence? And if you think about Israel and the church and the United States as God's three chosen peoples, you get violence. Third, the David traditions go back to the Abrahamic promise of chosenness without requirement. So in 2 Samuel 7, I will keep your dynasty forever. If you sin, I will punish you, but I will never take my chesed from you. So thank you, Jesus. And Solomon picked up on that. And my read of Solomon is that Solomon turned the unconditional promise of God into a totalism. Seems like a long time since we did that on Tuesday, isn't it? He was Pharaoh's son-in-law. And one has the impression that the temple was essentially so that he could exhibit his gold, in which he encased Yahweh. And he had these tight tax collecting districts, and he had forced labor, and he was an arms dealer. And there's one verse that says he ate more meat in a day than anybody in that economy should have eaten in a year. And the totalism is impinged upon at his death when his unwitting son Rehoboam tries to become king, and it kind of collapses in a violent tax revolt in which the IRS officer for Solomon is killed by the mob. That's the Old Testament so far. So the crisis of chosenness become totalism is, can this be interrupted? Can it be broken open? And my simple thesis this morning is that the prophetic movement is the breaking open of the totalism. Every totalism depends upon an idol. And Solomon's idol was Yahweh without agency. He believed in Yahweh. He just locked him up in the box with no agency. The prophetic movement consists in uncredentialed agents who claim to act and voice the agency of Yahweh. If you think about the totalism, the prophetic action and voice are from elsewhere. That's the most we know. They are from elsewhere. They are an act of imagination. When they got asked, "Where'd you get that?" they said, which is beyond demonstration, "Thus saith Yahweh." So Yahweh is portrayed in their very historical appearance as an agency who comes from outside of the totalism and is not contained in the totalism. So the first big move of this intrusion into the totalism in the 9th century is with Elijah and Elisha. Now, it's too bad that most of the commentaries I read say, well, Elisha is simply a shadowy echo of Elijah. Whoever wrote that didn't read the narratives. I think even more than Elijah, Elisha brings the agency of Yahweh. And what the narratives show is Elisha has immense agency, and the king who presides over the totalism has no agency at all. So in 2 Kings chapter 5, when he heals the Syrian leper general Nahum, he heals him, and Nahum wants to copay. He wants to make it a business transaction. He says, "How much do I owe you?" And Elisha said, this is all free. But if you move through the narrative, the general first goes to the Israelite king, the northern Israelite king, who remains nameless because we don't care what his name is. And the king, when he gets asked to heal, says, "Am I a god? I can't do healing." So the narrative wants to set it up is that this agent from outside can do what the chairman of the totalism cannot do. In chapter 6, 2 Kings, Elisha has agency to make peace with the Syrians. You remember what he does. He prays them into blindness and then he prays them back to sight. And the king makes a brief appearance in the narrative, and all the king can say is, "Can I kill him?" Well, that's not agency. And Elijah said, no, we're going to serve them a banquet. We're not going to kill them. And then they had peace. And in chapter 7, Elisha works out in an odd way to provide food in the famine. But when these two helpless women come to the king for food, he says, well, get God to help you. How can I help you? I can't give you food. So he can't heal. He can't make peace. He can't bring food in famine. He can't do any of the things that kings are supposed to be able to do. He cannot deliver the way totalisms promise they will deliver. So I've been thinking 1 and 2 Kings ought to be entitled 1 and 2 Kings. But I suppose you can't have a book of the Bible that ends in a question mark. I don't know. Extraordinary stories in which they show that the energy and force of life is carried by those who are rooted outside of the totalism, and thereby the totalism of the monarchy is deconstructed. You don't have to use that fancy word, but the truth of the matter is that Jesus went about Galilee doing good and deconstructing all old totalistic authority that had no power to transform. So when you get to the 8th century and the prophets that we know because there are books left bearing their names, however complicated the editorial process might have been. I thought you'd like to know I know about that. And what they consistently do in a variety of imaginative ways is that they bring to voice the agency of Yahweh. They talk God back into dangerous action. They bear witness that the God captured in Jerusalem is not domesticated and is, in fact, dangerous to the regime. So in my book entitled Reality, Grief, Hope, which I commend to you with enthusiasm, I have proposed and lined out that those are the three great prophetic tasks that have urgency. The first prophetic task is to voice reality, to describe reality that has been covered over by ideology so that it is not noticed. And reality is covered over by ideology by the use of euphemisms, by calling things by their wrong name. And what the prophets do is to call things by their right name. So in Isaiah 5, one of his little woe passages, he says, woe to you that call bitter sweet and sweet bitter. Woe to you who call things by their wrong name. But the whole advertising game is to call things by their wrong name. You notice that the law requires that ads be honest. So you get the drug on the screen, but you have to listen very carefully for the voice that says you may get constipation or diarrhea or a heart attack or cancer or die or kidney failure. That's over there. So the reality that the prophet's voice, and I worked really hard on this phrase, is, are there non-transgressible limits to lived reality? Or can a totalism so screen reality that you can do anything? Realism is bearing witness to the non-transgressible limits up with which Yahweh will not put. Didn't end that with a preposition. Second prophetic task, if people catch on to reality, the second prophetic task is to help the community engage in grief over loss, about what cannot be sustained. So I have been inching toward the conclusion that the prophets do not speak in anger, they speak in sadness. They speak in sadness that what we have so treasured is unsustainable. Jerry, this rich old conservative in our church, my pastor told me his greeting instead of Hail Mary full of grace, he says, "What's up?" I guess he learned that in CPE, I don't know. So he says, "What's up, Jerry?" And Jerry had tears in his eyes. He says, "What's up?" And Jerry, this is the guy who said, "How long do we have to care for poor people?" Jerry said, "I want my world back." Because he knew down here that it was gone. Well, all whites want their world back, and all males want their world back, and all straights want their world back, and all want their world back. And in Jerusalem, they wanted their world back. It's gone. That world is over. The prophets hook up the truth-telling with the grief work with a therefore. I wouldn't know whether these transgressions produce these losses, but they do in poetry, because in poetry things can be connected in ways that do not rely on too much data. So grief work is an antidote to denial, because the totalism is capable of unending denial. After reality and after grief, the third prophetic task I have suggested is hope. But not before the first two tasks. We rush to hope. So I worked hard on this phrase too. Hope is bearing witness to the originary stirrings of God's Spirit toward newness. Now, every time I write originary, some copy editor crosses it out and writes original. If I had to want to write original, I would have written original. Originary is a generative process. The originary stirrings of God's Spirit that is making something possible that the totalism could not have imagined. So after I had written that book, I stumbled on this Micah 3:4 text. And I thought, oh, I wish I had known about this text. Chapter 3, verses 9 through 11, in my rubric, is a prophetic articulation of reality. I want you to observe two things about this so that you can practice it. First of all, it's poetry. You should never get involved in prophetic arguments that are prose because you cannot win them. But poetry is kind of playful and open, and you can turn it and you can hear it or you can not hear it, whatever you like. I think too much of our testimony is prose. Second thing to observe, you probably know this, that poetry in the Old Testament, the prophets and the Psalms, are characteristically parallelism. Say everything twice. And that's it's a good discipline. After you say something, to ask, how could I say it another way? The great book on this, if you are interested, is by Robert Alter, who is a Jewish scholar at the University of California. It's called The Art of Biblical Poetry. And what he argues is that the second line of the parallelism is always an intensification of the first, which is to say this is hugely artistic work. And my own sense about the church is that our ethical passion often has crowded out our artistic sensibility. So look at the parallelism. Hear this, that's a Shema from Deuteronomy. Shema! The parallelism, ruler's chief, house of Israel, house of Jacob. You who abhor justice, you who pervert equity. You who build Zion with blood, you who build Jerusalem with wrong. Perfect parallelisms. So he has described social reality. Social reality is injustice, inequity, and to build with blood is an idiom that in some other places means oppressive cheap labor. Doesn't have to mean that, but sometimes it does. And then in verse 11, you have a parallelism in three lines. It's rulers, it's priests, it's prophets. The three constitute, along with the scribes and the bankers, there were bankers in Jerusalem, constitute the elite power structure of the totalism who benefited from the produce of the peasants. So it's rulers take bribes. So I read a quiz recently. Which state has more governors in prison, Illinois or New Jersey? I didn't know the answer. Its priests teach for a price. Well, maybe that's, I don't know, tax exemptions or clergy discounts. I don't know. Its prophets give oracles for money. Now, if you look at that, those three, rulers, priests, prophets, bribe, price, money, you can rearrange them any way you like, because they're all synonyms. Yet, always look for a disjunction in the price. Yet! Well, you don't have to say it that loudly. They say, you know, we are God's chosen people. Nothing bad will ever happen to us because the promise to Abraham and to David is unconditional. Never nothing about not taking bribes or anything like that. So I think it'll be all right. The ideology of chosenness thought that the commitments of God would give cover for transgressing non-transgressible limits. It is a non-transgressible limit to practice injustice. Therefore, verse 12 is grief work. Therefore, because of you, you rulers, you chiefs, you rulers, you priests, you prophets, you privileged elite who live off of the income of the peasants, you ownership class. And then you have a three-line parallelism, Zion, Jerusalem, mountain of the house. Those are all parallels. And the destination, field, heap of ruins, wooded height. Who would have thought that the therefore would connect injustice with the destruction of Jerusalem? The ideology practices denial. So every presidential candidate is going to promise the recovery of the economy. Everything is, it's bottomed out and we're going to be all right. The truth of the matter is that not even Hillary knows what to do. Nobody knows what to do. And you've noticed, nobody knows what to do in Iraq. They haven't even said anything. They haven't even criticized the president because nobody knows what to do. But we will no doubt prevail because we always prevail. It's our habit to prevail. And this therefore rings in the ear. That's the end of chapter 3. It must have been a very long pause before chapter 4. I assume that these lines in chapter 3 and these lines in chapter 4 had nothing to do with each other. They were not related poems. But some editor put them together. Maybe it was an editorial committee and they discussed it a long time. Well, they said, let's just go with it. So now we are at the third prophetic task, which is hope. Because if 3:12 is true, you've got to be left with despair. So the third prophetic task is to meet the despair of the totalism with announcement of hope, which is an announcement of God's originary stirrings toward newness. In the days to come, we don't know when. We don't even know how. We just know in the days to come. And then notice these poems lock together because you have mountain in 3:12 and in 4:1. You have the highest middle. So the references to Zion, Jerusalem, and mountain are picked up in the new poem. And it will all be established as a pivot point for the nations. And the nations, maybe they have been reading Psalm 122. I was glad when they said to me, let us go up to the house of the Lord. Let us go up to the mountain. Let us go up to the house. In order that, and here's the parallelism, teach us his ways, walk in his paths, teach us his paths, walk in his ways, because out of Zion shall go forth Torah. The word is Torah in the Hebrew. So the word Torah is parallel to the word word in Jerusalem and Zion. And if you study the Torah, and when the when the word Torah is used, it almost always in subsequent use means the book of Deuteronomy. And if you study that tradition, you will see that Yahweh is the great equalizer between the strong and the weak. And when Yahweh adjudicates between the strong and the strong will figure out that their weapons aren't going to work anymore, so they will disarm. And then you get the parallelism, sword, spears, plowshares, hooks, pruning hooks, and not learn war anymore. The days are coming when the nations will not practice war. Someday somebody in power is going to read that and say, well, why don't we just start? Why don't we just start now? Now, you may know that far, this poem appears in Isaiah 2. We usually quote it from Isaiah. Same thing. So if the poem occurs in Isaiah and in Micah, that means it probably was a well-known, free-floating poem, and everybody could use it. You stick it in here, you stick it in there, whatever you like to do. But the amazing thing is that Micah adds the rest of it. Isaiah is a city guy. He's trying to figure out how he get food into the city. But Micah is a rural guy. And Micah knows that the way to have peace is just to have one vine, one fig tree, a lower standard of living. What Micah knows is if you disarm, you cannot continue rabid consumerism. You will have to settle for a little. And you probably won't even be able to fly off to Spokane to a conference, which is, as Andy said, a gift of totalism. You just sit under your vine and your fig tree and watch the peace go by. And nobody's threatened. And then this fifth verse. I just found this fifth verse. We got a stream of the nations, a procession, a peace and justice and disarmament procession on the way to Torah that consists in many peoples. I thought of this when Anne was describing this amazing neighborliness between Christians and Muslims in Cairo. Each will operate in the name of its own God. We're going to continue to worship Yahweh of the troops. Nobody's going to talk us out of our covenant tradition. But we're going to let the others be. They don't need to be converted. They don't need to be one to our narrative. So we will be in a procession of many like-minded allies, all of whose faith traditions breed peace and justice. And it may be, it doesn't say so, but it may be that Micah had figured out that as long as you make absolute claims for your faith and have to convert everybody, there will never be peace or justice. I don't know whether you find that verse upsetting. I sort of did. But it has caused me to do an incredible rethink. Now, you pastors, I know you can't talk about any of this in your church. It's too dangerous. And my priest, my Episcopal priest, even with my great urging of him, will just walk up to the edge of it, even though he knows he must. And you must.
You must, or the totalism will devour us, which it is doing. So go easy. The idea is not to upset people. The idea is not to make people angry. The idea is not to have confrontation. The idea is to pause enough to let people have the artistic experience that the story of the world can be told differently outside of ideology and denial and despair. But if it is not told otherwise, we have no chance of recognizing our ideology, our denial, our despair, because we think they're just normal. So let God's people have the text. Let them sit with the text. And you know, it is inspired text, which means that the Spirit works in the reading of it. And every once in a while, connections are made. I learned in psychotherapy that one connection made by me is worth 1,000 suggestions by the therapist. One connection made by the congregation is worth 1,000 connections made by the pastor. But the connections cannot be made if the script isn't available. So now I will violate that rule and make some suggestions. Does this text strike you as contemporary? So the prophetic task in the market ideology that is our totalism is to ask, what are the non-transgressible limits? Is it torture? Is it mass incarceration? Is it the wealth gap? Is it low wages on which you cannot possibly live? Or what would you say? You put that to a serious, thoughtful group in the congregation, you'll get a list. People know what the non-transgressible limits are. And then it's easy to ask, what do you think the outcomes of transgressing those non-transgressible limits might be? And people know. And then you have a chance to ask, where do you identify the originary stirrings of the Spirit towards newness? Where you can see it in the emerging of a new economy through the co-op movement. My son is doing sociology of food, and he says, if I owned Kroger's, I would be, is a Kroger out here? Its base is in Cincinnati. He said, Fred Meyer. Different names for the same outfit. He says, if I owned Kroger, I'd be nervous about the co-op movement, neighbor-to-neighbor food. Or is God's originary stirring a new ecumenism in which Jews, Christians, Muslims can be in procession for peace and justice without having to convert each other? It's an amazing thought. So if you look at this text, 3:9-12 is displacement, and 4:1-5 is restoration to newness. If you transpose that into Christian categories, 3:9-12 is about crucifixion, and 4:1-5 is about resurrection to a new life. No Friday, no Sunday. No truth-telling against denial, no hope-telling against despair. Would you think it an overstatement if I said to you that the church is the only body left to bring a critical word from outside the totalism about the failure of the totalism and the possibility of the neighborhood? Jesus did not come to take us to heaven. Jesus came to invite us to discipleship, to an alternative way. And I have noticed you are on your way rejoicing. Well, we have a couple minutes. Yes. Well, John Calvin has this great hymn, "Our hope is in no other save in thee alone." The facts on the ground, I think, or it's implied in your question, do not provide much ground for hope. And it would be easy to give in. I assume the reason we meet together is remind each other not to give in. So it will take an intrusion from the outside into the totalism. The totalism, grounded in idolatry, cannot save itself. And I am as committed as I am able to be to the truth of that intrusion. I am always at the edge of being addicted by the totalism. I've been tenured forever. The whole point of tenure is you don't have to worry anymore. But it turns out that tenure doesn't deliver that. So that's where I am. Yep. It is always seduced. The church is always seduced into being a part of the totalism. That is why we have to keep our nose in these hard texts, because the texts are addressed to us before they're addressed to anybody else. So Amos can say, "You only have I known, chosen, therefore, you only." Yeah, exactly. Well, I had the impression there is such an intrusion going on in Cairo.
Christianity today on a good day is an intrusion.